This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. And today, for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guests are Karen Sanchez, who is currently associate professor at Leiden University, moving shortly to Groningen University, as she will be the next chair of the Middle Eastern Studies department. And my other guest is Sari Zananiri, who is currently a postdoctoral researcher at Leiden University. Now, with them, we're going to talk about an edited book, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2021, and it's available as open access. European Cultural Diplomacy and Arab Christians in Palestine, 1918-1948, Between Contention and Connection. Now, this book is also part of a series of other works connected to a funded project, Crossroads, which we will talk about that later. But first of all, Karen and Sari, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Roberto, for welcoming us.
Yes, thank you indeed.
So to begin with, I would like to ask you something about yourself. So perhaps starting with Karen, can you tell us a little bit more about your background? And the same question then for Sari.
It's very easy. I'm a historian. And I started with one PhD on the missionary challenges in the south of Palestine during the Mandate period with Bernard Héberger in Paris. And the second one was dealing with the relation between language identification and education in Jerusalem. So I've been working mainly with historians until 2015, I would say. And then I came across more sociolinguistics colleagues in Leiden University, in CNRS, where I kept contact. And so I came from these two mainly research background. When I was in Bethlehem, and then I can tell you how I came to a crossroad idea, research proposal, and then grant.
And I did a PhD in fine arts, so I have a background as an arts practitioner, really. And I think for me, you know, coming to this project around cultural diplomacy was a lot about thinking about the ways in which culture affects so much of the other sort of aspects of life. In my PhD, I was looking a lot at photography and the ways in which photography can speak to sort of broader political narratives. So I was thinking a lot about how Western photography has a confluence with Zionist narrative, thinking about the ways in which kind of culture functions in terms of remediating Palestine, you know, this very sort of important religious place to the world, but also thinking about the ways in which some of these modes of religious imaging actually kind of don't really reflect the realities of a multilingual and multicultural society and, you know, the sort of many diversities of communities that were living there. And I think that's kind of how I came to sort of really be thinking a lot more about kind of contexts of cultural diplomacy within the sort of the broader context of Crossroads and the activities that we've been working on in the last few years.
We certainly talk about extensively about the concept of cultural diplomacy, but I just want to mention for all of the listeners that Sari is also an excellent artist, and in fact, some of his pictures are great and they can be found online. And I'll make sure that also his personal website will be posted so that people can actually enjoy those works. Now, I want to move to the book and ask about the genesis of the project. In fact, the very introduction of the book itself is called The Genesis of the Project Dedicated to European Cultural Diplomacy. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how the book was originally conceived and also how did the project develop?
The very first idea was back in 2014-15 when I was in the Bethlehem University looking for other types of archives dealing with education. And I came across the El Rad, and I was very struck by all these association around cultural activity in the countryside by young men of the 30s. So during the Arab Revolt, I kept those, you know, I wrote down what I was reading, and I discussed with a very dear colleague of mine, Helen Muir-Vandenberg, at that time, who were involved in another project, Arabic and its Alternative. And I was telling her I was really struck by the use of cultural association to fight the British via literacy activities. So I dig a bit when I had time, but I was involved in something else. And I found out that actually those associations ended up by being a very important Arab student association across the region. And so being in Jerusalem, I remember, and Bethlehem and also Nablus at that time, I was discussing the name I found from these students and trying to look into the networks. And via this idea, I discussed more and more the use of cultural association. And I came up with this proposal, Crossroads, and then this has another history. But I think that the moment I decided to dig a bit was to inquire more about this idea of influencing and fighting via culture. And then when I was granted, I was looking for people who would have a very complementary approach. So I was delighted to meet Sari and to make him come to Leiden.
And it's been a pleasure to be here ever since. Thank you, Karen. I think sort of coming into the project as a postdoc and all of this amazing sort of thinking and conceptualization that Karen had done kind of coming into it, I think it's sort of definitely shaped the kind of the parameters of the project. But I think one of the things that I found most interesting was thinking again, you know, kind of going back to this sort of idea of photography and how this creates links, transnational links. I think, you know, thinking about these transnational links that kind of come out of a lot of these religious frameworks and institutional frameworks that are kind of embedded in the book, I think it became a very interesting exercise in thinking through how frameworks can kind of how the framework of religion can kind of be a connector as much as a sort of a moment of contention, which I suppose is somewhat reflected in the book's title. You know, I think, you know, when we go through the various chapters in the book, there are clearly success stories of cultural diplomacy and stories of you know, failure at the same time. And I think this is a very sort of multi-directional process, which I think, you know, it sort of speaks to the complexity of the field.
And I think being involved in different type of archival work, we quickly came to realize that even in institutions that are very central and that some of our colleagues may perceive as unidirectional institutions like the Vatican, some institutions were devoted to address, you know, cultural aspects of local populations, but not only devoted to that after the First World War, but mainly indigenous and local actors, whether within this institution or outside, had a huge agenda and were also very influential. So I think that's the genesis of the project, going way beyond an idea of unidirectional Cold War idea of the cultural diplomacy and try to envisage the entanglement and multifaceted aspects.
Now, the book is divided into three parts, 18 chapters, with the addition of an introduction and an epilogue. And central to the volume is obviously the concept of cultural diplomacy. Would you be able to tell us your definition or how, you know, this definition evolved throughout the book, and how also perhaps scholars engage with the term cultural diplomacy?
There's no unique definition. I think we have to underline that from the very beginning, because Leiden University is involved, for example, in what is called by my colleague Giles Scott-Smith, the new diplomatic history. And they are pushing also to look into other way cultural diplomacy has evolved. So taking into account, I think, several types of historiography where you have, you know, Charlotte Fouché, for example, trying to define cultural influence and how this cultural influence is seen in different type of actors of diplomacy, whether they are statal actors or not, taking into account new diplomatic approach, and taking into account as well our own background of historian and cultural studies specialists, looking into this idea of going beyond a state definition, and how this cultural influence was remodeled and rewritten locally, we can refer, you know, to three main fields of cultural diplomacy definition. But I think one of the conclusions is that it's a very complex and entangled concept, and the discussion of the concept itself was one of the goals of the book, and I think we succeeded to achieve that. You have some of the authors who immediately understood when coming and discussing with us a more top-down approach that they accepted, you know, to challenge while writing their papers. Other immediately understood a more local definition of what cultural influence and agency can be. And then you had cultural studies specialists who saw the idea of reception, production, consumption. So I think the main idea we took from this book is that there are various definitions, but all of them are dealing with the idea of production, consumption, influence at different levels.
Yeah, I mean, I think many of the authors in the and contributors in the volume, you know, they've kind of spoken to various degrees about what cultural diplomacy kind of means to them and defined that. But I think, you know, certainly the process of kind of discussion that led to the volume and some of the workshops that we'd had earlier on in Crossroads, I think one of the most appealing ways of thinking about cultural diplomacy really comes from David Clark's cultural studies approach to it. And I think, you know, this really, the thing about that approach is that it's not so much a definition of cultural diplomacy as a sort of an analysis of all of these networks. And I think this is a really valuable way of thinking about cultural diplomacy, because it does have so many different actors in it. And in the context of Palestine, there's no state that reflects the actors that we're discussing, you know, in this case, Arab, Christian, Palestinians. So in some ways, thinking about the sort of networks that function, whether they're sort of supranational networks, whether they're kind of commercial networks, I think this kind of can yield a lot of valuable historical knowledge. And I think this is also partially why we structured the book the way we did, with a section looking at Palestinian cultural diplomacy, a section looking at mixed forums, and a section looking at European cultural diplomacy. And I think this was, you know, the structure of the book was very much an attempt to sort of think about the ways in which cultural diplomacy flows backwards and forwards. And, you know, I think the ways in which Palestine is often couched in slightly more popular terms is that people didn't have a lot of agency, but actually what we see is that there was quite a lot of agency. And, you know, even within this sort of messy political period of the British Mandate, people were still working within these sort of networks that they had access to try and influence people.
It's certainly very clear from the structure of the book that the usual and very old stereotypes that essentially depicted the Palestinians, as you said, without any agency is challenged. And it demonstrates that actually there was a clear agency on the ground, and the Palestinians were producing their own present and projecting their own future. And here I want to ask you about, the question why you looked at the Christians. And since the book is very much looking at Arab Christians in Palestine, as I said earlier in the introduction, between 1918 and 1948. And I was wondering, is there a case for a different cultural diplomacy towards other communities in Palestine, for instance, Muslims and Jews, or it was just a sort of a practical necessity to focus on one group?
That's a fundamental question. And I must say that we have a very connected approach. I need to say that because as an historian, I came, you know, from the background of analyzing these relations in the south of Palestine. So for me, of course, the Jewish community, the Muslim majority in Hebron, and the tiny, you know, missionary Christian were all involved in this very complex configuration of the mandate. So our goal with this book was absolutely not to target randomly because it would be, I don't know, easier. But we have several context elements that allow us, I think, from a scientific background, to target these Arab Christian, but in a very connected and comparative approach. So, for example, the fact that there is a lack of Ottoman cultural investment in minorities, and we all know the millet system, favored this significant cultural autonomy. I mean, the work of Bernard Héberger or Fogel underlined that before this book. And so this is one type of justification. The other one is the one I was working with for several years. It's this idea that the growth of Western schools, I mean, you have the French one, you have the Russian schools in Jerusalem, the Italian one, but not only, were in fact geared mainly at Christian communities, though they were accepting Jewish and Muslim people. A third type of explanation is the tendency to hail from urban rather than rural background. And so this was also a way of, you know, Christian to be more active. And of course, this was, Sari said, facilitated by the network of these Arab Christian, whether it was mercantile or professional network. And I'm thinking of another one. It's the fact that clearly the British policy in the Mandate in Palestine addressed directly Jews and Muslims. So when the British are saying Arab, we all know by now that they meant Muslims more than Christian. And that's why we came up with a very rich archival, database, and at the same time, huge gaps in the analysis of this cultural diplomacy. And then, of course, sorry, we add to that the many aspects that are dealing with more cultural studies aspect of this Arab Christian, for example.
Yeah, I think Karina's kind of really encapsulated many of the sort of reasons why we sort of deal with Christianity. But I also think that within a sort of a broader narrative of some of the cultural institutes that were being set up in Palestine in this late Ottoman and British Mandate period and were very much in operation during the British Mandate is that so many of them were related to Christianity. So there was also, part of this relationship to Christianity, whether you're thinking about it from the perspective of facilitating tourism, like institutions like Notre Dame or the Austrian Hospice, or whether you're sort of thinking about it from a scholarly perspective, like, institutions like Ecole Biblique or the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem, or, these many, many different archaeological and ethnographic institutes that are being set up, is that you already have this kind of interest in Christianity. And, I suppose that part of this kind of relationship of these institutes and the sort of funding that's coming from the various states that are setting them up is also related to outreach within Christian communities. So we get this sort of aspect of, not just missionizing, but also sort of, carving out these sort of spheres of cultural affinity. And that's not to say that this is unique to Christians. Certainly we clearly see, Protestant affinities with Judaism as well in other aspects, or, a sort of transnational kind of pan-Islamic cultural affinities. But I think within the context of Palestine, I think that the role of Christianity is just so very strong in shaping, so many of the social forces that were present. And I think, in some ways, given that Christians were, numerically quite small in comparison to the Muslim majority, I think there was also sort of a much larger cultural impact that they had within the context of the British Mandate that kind of overrides their sort of the sort of numeric population.
And actually, talking about the British Mandate, I was wondering, how did cultural diplomacy develop under the British?
Do you mean in a sort of a general sense, or in terms of British cultural diplomacy, or
perhaps in general? I mean, looking at the context, I guess obviously, still the French institutions, Austrian institutions, they kept working, their own way, but also they probably have been influenced by the new socio-political setting after the British took over at the end of World War One.
Certainly, there's quite a few chapters that deal with archaeology, for instance, and I think this is a really interesting kind of moment in terms of archaeology and, the sort of the ways in which archaeology, not that we sort of deal with museology in the book, but I think, there's this sort of relationship towards how these archaeological institutes are kind of shaping this kind of museological image of Jerusalem and of Palestine more generally, all of these dig sites that are kind of springing up. And I think, for instance, Sarah Irving's paper in the book, looks at the role of Christians within the Palestine Archaeological Museum. And I think there we can kind of see this very interesting impact. On the one hand, we've got this new museum that's being set up that's kind of got an Ottoman predecessor but is kind of being couched as distinctly British. It's not generally servicing local populations. It's more about visitation and kind of building tourism and things like that. But then we have these sort of attempts to couch some sort of Palestinian narrative in the ways in which guidebooks are being written by these Christian Palestinians, by the ways in which, sites are managed and thinking about these sorts of history. So I think, And I guess with the other sort of big context of the British Mandate, you know, is also, of course, the fact that it was constantly marked by, you know, nationalist clashes, which obviously result in the creation of Israel and the Nakba in 1948. So, you know, we also sort of need to see this as a space in which there's multiple cultural diplomacies that are vying for influence. And in many ways, this is a sort of a nexus of a lot of worlds, you know, in this period.
Mm. And it's also a period where every type of actor actually understand the power of this cultural influence. So if you take, you know, very expected actors like the French cultural diplomacy, but also the British. This is the moment where you have the creation of the British Council. If you look into these archives, I'm working on that now, and you realize that the cultural diplomacy is very present in the creation of the center, but also the goal. So the idea is a very light one, the peace between Arab and Jews. I mean, via cultural diplomacy, it's absolutely fascinating that in the mid of the 30s, facing this Arab revolt and with all the mistakes from a diplomatic and political point of view, they reached this idea. And that you have people like Humphrey Bowman writing very clearly that every population communities writing has his language, and so they cannot communicate, and English is the language of peace. So you have the fact that they want to invest in this cultural diplomacy to reach political goal. And I mean, you know that from an Italian point of view, your chapter is looking into that very well. With the French, it's exactly the same. So this is why, on top of everything Sari mentioned, the period, it was the missing gap for cultural diplomacy in Palestine, of course.
Let me move to the first part of the book, which you already mentioned. Now, the first part of the book is dedicated to the discussion of the indigenization of cultural diplomacy. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about what does this mean, and also how did the various authors discuss and argue the indigenization of cultural diplomacy?
Yeah. Many of them, not all of them, came to the conclusion that many indigenous actors at different level were very conscious about the impact of cultural negotiation and production. So the term itself was not very loaded in one specific historiography. I think it's important to say that. But we all came to the conclusion that it's totally unavoidable to have them at the center of the analysis. And I think many authors, and I will then, Sari, of course, will jump in to give you other examples. But for most of the author, the fact that indigenous actors were fundamental in how they were involved in remodeling, rewriting, or having an influence on European actors remodeling and rewriting concepts, I mean, designs, local communication was our starting point for in the indigenization of our approach. I think the other element, we all came, even when trying, you know, to trace whether Swedish influence or Russian, with the idea that these relations with indigenous actors were entangled at all level. And so, again, you cannot, you know, overlook them. And I think the third idea was that indigenous actors, quite question the legitimacy of the ruling state, so the Imperial Britain. So with these three ideas, we started to discuss the indigenous presence in our analysis. That's, I would say, first. Then I let Sari develop.
And I think that the other factor as well is kind of thinking about the sort of diversity of how culture functioned, you know, across many of the different chapters there. I mean, you know, we've got chapters about music, we've got chapters about education, we've got chapters about literature, we've got chapters about sort of cities and urban space, and we've got other chapters about clubs and associations. So I think, you know, this sort of gives us a really sort of wide field to think about how people were using cultural diplomacy and the forums in which they were using cultural diplomacy. And I think sometimes it, you know, it speaks to, you know, very conscious knowledge of the power of cultural diplomacy in the moment, as we see with Sharbel Nassif's work, you know, where, you know, Archbishop Hajar from the Melkite community is actively kind of playing imperial powers off against one another. But other times it's, you know, it's much more subtle, you know. So, for instance, Sadiag Sous working on, you know, modern Arabic novels and you know, these sort of Russian links, you know. I mean, this is a cultural field, obviously, but is this, you know, does this look like diplomacy from the outside, or is this a sort of a reframing within a context to understand how these networks function? And I think it's, you know, in many ways, this is kind of the latter. You know, I'm not sure that people who were involved in production in culture at that particular moment would have understood what they were doing within this context of cultural diplomacy. But I think that this sort of underscores why it's so important to be thinking about cultural diplomacy in such a broad way. And, you know, I think... you know, in many ways, there's sort of moments of sort of cognizance, particularly around the idea of, you know, in something like music or literature or other sort of fields like this, of sort of artistic authenticity, you know, particularly in the context of Maria Chiara's Rioli's article about, you know, music. You know, I think this is a moment where, you know, a Palestinian musician is kind of using these structures of the Latin patriarchate to his own ends. But I also think that part of being a Christian Palestinian is kind of holding some sort of notional space of authenticity within this kind of much larger structure. And so I think, you know, as we kind of go through a lot of those chapters, I think that there is just such an interesting kind of lineage of different things that are kind of going on culturally in this period that can be addressed through this framework, but also, you know, sort of reflect the sort of the ways in which actually, like, anybody who was involved in the sort of practices of culture in that period, in some ways were kind of contesting something or another in some way, you know. So it sort of speaks to the politicization of daily life in many ways.
And I wanted to ask you something about sort of a geography of cultural diplomacy, because I guess for readers and those who are interested in Palestine, it would be very obvious to say that Jerusalem was this place where, you know, culture was produced and consumed. But obviously, Palestine is bigger than Jerusalem itself. And in fact, a number of chapters, I would say, look at different parts of the country, and particularly they're looking at Haifa for different reasons, because it was a financial and commercial hub, but more importantly, because it hosted a large Christian population, particularly the Melkites. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the community itself, and also the role of Haifa in the production and consumption of European cultural diplomacy.
Absolutely. From a geographical point of view, Palestine is not only Jerusalem. So we were obsessed by that, and it's very good that you underline it. There are many cities and countryside we try to check, having in mind, of course, that these Arab Christians were more present in the cities than in the countryside, but in Galilee and in other they were present in the countryside. So thank you for this remark. Second, why this Melkite community? The Catholic presence is very interesting in the sense that the link with Europeans is very old, depending on different network, cultural ones. So the Melkites are very close at that time to the French population for many different reasons, other historians developed in the past. And so via these religious language, old network and professional ones, you have a population. So the Melkites are mainly living in Galilee during this period, and very few of them only in Jerusalem, obviously for religious reasons, are developing their own agenda within the Catholic and to a larger extent Christian communities. They are also very much active into being and very proud of being and promoting Arab Christianity. And for many aspects, they are opposing Arab Orthodox, but they are also very active in using their cultural influence to promote the idea that Palestinians are very nationalist outside Palestine. So they send delegates, they send bishop. One of the chapter is insisting on Bishop Gregorius Hajar, but he was not the only one. They have the ability to quickly reach public audience in France and in all the Francophone countries, so Switzerland, Belgium, with a wide network. Of course, financially, it's interesting, but they are also exporting, cultural good via this influence. And they are also promoting the idea that Palestine is irremediably linked to Arabic as a language. So in terms of cultural policy, it has a lot of implication, because this means that all the religious training, all the schools for children, all the activities you may find around libraries, around literary salon, etc., are very much involved in different European actors. And the other aspect of this Melkite community is that they are able to have a real impact in the conceptual approach of what is to be a bilingual Palestinian at that time. And why it's important, because you have, during the French mandate, many discussions about what is to be, a Lebanese with trilingualism. Language is a way of thinking conceptually its identification. But you have the same with the Melkite community, because of this idea that you can't be Palestinian without mastering perfectly Arabic, and that's an obvious, setting in comparison with Lebanon at that time. But you also have to master other languages to promote the idea of the Palestinian cause outside. And the Melkites are very clear about that. There are other aspects, of course. We can come back to that later. I give the floor to Sari to add to that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstagram.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, I think the other thing about a city like Haifa, you know, there hadn't been borders in that region before, you know. So we also need to sort of think about it culturally as being situated somewhere between Jaffa and Beirut, you know. And obviously during the British Mandate period, it undergoes a massive transformation, you know, particularly as the British invest in Haifa as a sort of a port city. And I think, you know, this has big cultural effects on that city, and it changes quite dramatically. And I think, you know, Mayan Hillel's chapter, you know, discusses so many of these cultural changes, you know, whether it's beach culture, leisure culture, and the sort of, you know, the sort of the this sort of modern culture that develops in a city like that. But I think it's you know, it's very interesting to be sort of thinking about the sort of north as this sort of space that's in between, you know, and it must have been a very strange thing for the people that lived in these places at this time to experience suddenly having these borders in ways that hadn't existed, you know. And certainly we see that with Shabbal Nassif's article as well on the Melkites, you know, and this sort of severing of a community that winds up on different sides of the border, even though it's still much more permeable at that point. It's not like people can't travel like today, but it's, you know, I think it's this moment in which, you know, things are starting to shift. And I won't go into the Melkites, given that Keren has spoken so beautifully about them already. But I do think that this sort of shape of the and the space of the north is in many ways it's a very culturally different area to central Palestine, and you know, this space of Jaffa and Jerusalem, you know, the two larger cities and their kind of connection. And I would also say that that's also significantly different to what's happening in the south, you know, which is very deserty, you know, it's you know. So we also need to be sort of thinking about how even within Palestine, you know, that there is definitely work to be done between how these different regions are interacting with one another, not to mention with the new neighbours that they find, you know, around them in this period.
Let me move to the second part of the book, which looks at cultural diplomacy as a form of European hegemonic power. And I was wondering, how did Christians and the various Christian communities in Palestine react and or relate to this sort of form of European power?
That's a fundamental but very broad question. I think probably what we can say is that there's no homogeneous reaction. So you have, you know, very different reaction, whether where you situate yourself in the, you know, social configuration of Palestine. Some traders are very involved in this pilgrimage. They are, you know, targeting very specific European audience. Some are more interested by the education provided by Europeans. Others are trying to build long-term links to people coming back every year to Palestine, whether within, you know, specific religious communities or not. So I would say there is a wide range of reactions, and others simply do not care because they don't have, you know, any agency at their own level to interact directly with them or to benefit from that. But it depends very much on which type of European network we look, which type of part of the Palestinian society. So my overall answer would be, it would be very dangerous to try to qualify in one specific, you know, answer the various reaction. The relations are very, well, there are entanglements at several levels. So also to say that there is an absence, you know, of cultural links between the two is historical nonsense, of course. So the what we tried and we continue to do so. So lately we had a conference on vocabularies of tourism to try to tackle these very specific aspects last week. And even, you know, with tourism, you see the variety of answers. It's probably interesting for our auditors to know that they, in this, you know, broader range of power dynamic, we see this entanglement and real interest, whether it's cultural, economic, political, at several levels, and the role of individuals, religious communities, and parastatal organization is involved constantly during the mandate period. So the notion of encounter is multifaceted and influenced at several levels, these Palestinian Christians and, well, Palestinian society in a more general level, of course.
I mean, as Karen said, I think there are so many diverse approaches, it's hard to kind of, and would be ahistorical to kind of try and categorize them. But I think we can also sort of think about tendencies, you know. And I think, you know, there is tendencies for education. There are tendencies for scientific exploration. There are tendencies for, you know, pilgrimage, you know. But again, you know, we're talking about a whole diversity of European states, and that's before discussing the rest of the world, you know, whether it's North America or more about Palestinian relationships to other parts of the global South or whatever like that, you know. So it's, you know, I mean, I think it is such a huge field, and I think there is still quite a lot of work to be done within it in terms of thinking through some of this sort of stuff. But I do also think, you know, one of the things to kind of consider in terms of your question is how some of these fields interact, you know. And I think when we look at some of the, you know, the sort of the contexts of the chapters, you know, we do have actors like the Vatican or the Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society or, you know, a number of other kind of groupings who are involved in various, you know, multiple activities at the same time. So I think we can also be thinking about these actors as being involved in multiple aspects of cultural diplomacy. And certainly, you know, with something like the Russian Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society, I mean, you know, they were becoming inactive by the beginning of the British Mandate and the sort of, you know, political changes in Russia. But we do see them engaged with education, with pilgrimage and facilitating Russian pilgrimage, as well as also, you know, being involved in these scientific endeavors. And I think, you know, in some ways we need to be thinking about how different aspects of cultural diplomacy coming from a particular country or coming from a particular place interact and interweave with one another, and what sort of effects that has on the indigenous populations, what effects that has on, you know, those foreign populations, how this connection changes things, you know. And I think one of the things that we do sort of tend to see is that you know, there is even in the chapters which are exploring a particular country's effects on Palestine, we still see transformations within that original country and in terms of their perceptions. And I think this is a very interesting point to be thinking about.
And this brings me to the third part of the book, where there are plenty of very interesting stories. In the third part of the book, the contributors essentially looked at a number of countries, you know, starting with Greece, Russia, Italy, France, Sweden, and this list is not obviously exhaustive. There are many others. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense, perhaps a short summary, of the work of these countries in Palestine and their interactions with local Christians.
As I said, something like Laura Gerd's chapter on the Imperial Orthodox Society, you know, they're sort of taking this very multi-pronged approach. And in some ways, we also see that with the Austrian policy that Barbara Haider Wilson discusses. You know, I think, on the one hand, the Austrian hospice is set up as this kind of, vehicle for pilgrimage. But on the other hand, they're also kind of using it to effectively raise the profile of Austria and the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Palestine, And I think, in some ways, your own chapter, Roberto, I think, it's a very interesting chapter because it's one of the chapters that deals with failure of cultural diplomacy in many ways. And I think that this is, this is not a story that we often think about. Like, how does, I think we tend to want to sort of highlight these tales of successes, but in many ways, thinking about the ways in which cultural diplomacy doesn't function in certain instances actually tells a very interesting story of connection and disconnection in another way, I think the failures of some of the propaganda, coming out of fascist Italy at the time, and radio stations and the inconsistencies of, this sort of operation, in some ways it tells a story that's as much about Italy's colonial failure as it does about, the communities in Palestine that were obviously very heavily influenced by Italy in other ways, And I think, things like Inga Marie's chapter on the Swedish school, I think this is another sort of interesting chapter that really deals with a very sort of large scale of interaction in a very micro setting of a school, the way she talks about, among all of the other educational policy, one of the things that I found particularly interesting of that chapter was discussing issues of fundraising and how that drew communities together, the production of objects in Palestine, handcrafts and things like that that were sold to Sweden, the importation of Swedish furniture to create this sort of idealized Swedish space, the sort of the postcards, the quaint Swedish postcards that were used to advertise the school. I think this really, it's a very it's a very warm story, that story, but it also looks at the ways in which culture can be transported, the way it can be repackaged, the way it can be consumed and even sold, I think it's quite a, in some ways there's some very very interesting pieces in that chapter.
I was a bit curious about the question of competition. I mean, obviously all of these foreign actors competed, but essentially for the same kind of population. And I was wondering if this raised tension between these countries, if there was some sort of agreement on the ground. How did they deal with the question of, competing with each other in a relatively small space?
Yeah, look, I think this is a very interesting question. And I think, we really see that best in the educational arena, actually, we can see it in lots of different spaces, but the rate at which new schools were being set up, the educational facilities that they were being equipped with, the languages that were being taught, the ways in which, parents were seeing education as a marketplace in this period, and I think the ways in which, people were thinking about what languages are useful to them, not just on a community level, but as part of a sort of a modern mercantile marketplace. I mean, the other thing that's very interesting about a lot of these institutions is that they might start up with specific focuses on a given community. And certainly we see that with the Russians addressing Orthodox or, Catholic education, French and Italian Catholic education systems being geared towards Catholic Palestinians, etc. But we also start to see that these communal boundaries, they get very porous very quickly, And certainly, you know, with Inga Marie talking about the Swedish school, you know, I mean, they're not solely taking Christian students, you know, they're very much advertising across the board. They're taking in Muslim students. They're, you know, they market towards Jewish students, but there are other Jewish structures which generally Jewish students kind of went into. So it's, you know, I mean, it's a very interesting thing thinking about this, you know, this context of education. But of course, the other thing with education that comes alongside it is language, you know, and I think, you know, this was one of the successes of the Russian education system, for instance, is that it, from the outset, they were teaching in Arabic, so it was sort of quite popular, you know, whereas I think other, you know, countries were kind of more interested in kind of guarding their language. And so actually, there's also sort of, you know, these kind of funny relationships that go back and forth between, you know, what is useful, you know, do should my kid learn French? Should my kid learn Swedish? Should my kid learn Russian? You know, I'm sure that these are all sorts of sort of questions that must be occurring to parents as they were, you know, dealing with these kind of questions of enrollment.
Well, in a sense, it shows that Palestine was a marketplace for education where parents had an opportunity to choose, you know, sort of a different kind of lines of education. Obviously, that had a social, economic, and I would say also political cost, because obviously deciding where to send the kids to school was not a neutral choice, but essentially makes Palestine sort of a great place for educating children, I would say. Would it be the same assessment, yours or the other authors?
I think if you were of a certain class, it was a very great place to be educated, you know. I mean, obviously, there's an Ottoman kind of government public school system that had been in existence before the First World War, and that continued under the British mandate afterwards. But I do think, you know, for these urban middle classes and upper middle classes and elites, you know, I think in these urban settings, I think it very much was a marketplace. And I think, you know, certainly sort of knowing people who'd been through that system, you know, and seeing the education that they received, you know, I think we can conclude that that it was a very successful strategy to influence, you know, Palestinian communities through an education system, you know. I suppose, you know, I think about some of the institutions that still exist today in various guises, like you know, the Frères College in Jerusalem or the Schneller School, or, you know, they've had continuity and longevity, and they're still seen as quite prestigious schools to send your children to, you know.
I have one more question, and it's very much about the epilogue or the conclusion. Now, the epilogue was written by Idir Wais, and I just wanted to mention him because he used to be a student of mine, so it was actually very nice to see him growing into a scholar and, you know, being able to sort of write the conclusion of this very fascinating volume. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of what conclusions have been reached. And I'm using here the plural because I suppose there's not only one way of looking at this volume, you know, given all of the various chapters that have been written in this edited work.
Yeah, look, I think Idir's epilogue is, you know, it's a wonderful piece of writing in terms of trying to capture the enormous field that we've tried to cover in a single book, you know. And as I said before, you know, I think there is so much more work to be done on this field. But I think, you know, he did such a great job of sort of thinking about, like, secularization of kind of various kind of cultural diplomacy apparatuses, thinking about, like, this Cold War context that was starting to develop, you know, in after 1917, thinking about, you know, the ways in which, you know, Arab contestation of the colonial ambitions in the region kind of functioned. And he was doing this not just not just with respect to, you know, British mandate Palestine, but also the French mandate. So I think he's kind of thinking, you know, it's a very nice regional approach to sort of cap the book off at the end there. But, you know, I mean, conclusions, yeah. It's, I mean, I think this is an edited volume with a lot of contributors, and, you know, it's the fruit of a collective effort, you know. And so I suppose each chapter has their own conclusion and their own, you know, their own sort of ideas on what, you know, what they've sort of dealt with. But I think, I mean, if we're sort of starting to kind of unpick, you know, some of the themes that really kind of come out of it, I mean, I think it sort of buttresses some of the, you know, I mean, I think there's always been this idea of sort of cultural spheres of influence of the colonial powers in Palestine. And I think that this really undermines the simplicity of this sort of assumption that that people just kind of fell willy-nilly into a sphere of influence and functioned within that. I think it kind of breaks down the idea that that actually, you know, this sort of Catholic versus Orthodox versus, you know, sort of what, you know, I mean, I think it undermines a lot of these sort of these simplistic notions of the way we see religious affiliation functioning in a sort of a colonial context and in a transnational context. And I think part of what's so interesting about that is that it shows that actually, even within communities, there often wasn't a consensus, you know. So I think there's, yeah, I mean, we might have this situation of kind of shifting from an Ottoman millet system into this kind of British mandate period. And I'm not saying that communal identity isn't important, but it's something that's also kind of part of a process of change. And I think, you know, we see the rise of Arab nationalism in a very concerted way in this period. And I think, you know, in some ways that has very interesting interactions with communal identity. And, you know, in some ways that sort of bolsters, and in other ways it also undermines. And I think it creates new series of relations and also a new series of, you know, conflicts. So I think, you know, part of this sort of interest in cultural diplomacy as a framework for thinking about the British Mandate period is also about trying to complicate and trying to understand this very messy, tangled period, and trying to, you know, in some ways untangle some of the tangle to understand entanglements, you know.
These were Karen Sanchez and Sari Zananiri, editors of European Cultural Diplomacy and Arab Christians in Palestine, 1918-1948, Between Contention and Connection, published by Palgrave Macmillan, available as open access. Karen and Sari, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Roberto.